almost all cases, we're going to reverse some orders, just because there's some people. We have some guests here, and just so people know, we have some of the lights off because we have some people who have injured their sight, and that the light is very, very hard on them. And so we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 284B, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 284B increases the statute of ultimate repose for product liability actions, including wrongful death, to 10 years or the statute of ultimate repose of the state in which the product was manufactured or from which it was imported, whichever is later. It exempts manufactured homes. It applies to causes of action arising after the effective date. It exempts physicians unless involved in the manufacture or design of the product. It exempts product liability actions for damages from halide or mercury vapor light bulbs from being subject to any statute of repose. Applies retroactively to halide or mercury vapor light bulbs product liability suits. The statute of ultimate repose is the time limit under which any product liability action for personal injury or property damage must be commenced. The time limit is currently 8 years. By comparison, the majority of other states, including Washington, California, and Idaho, have laws that ensure manufacturers are responsible for the safety of their product during the entire useful life of the product. Senate Bill 284B increases the statute of ultimate repose by 2 years and further stipulates that in cases where the product is manufactured in a state with a longer statute of ultimate repose, that state's time limit be considered.
Okay, and with that, we're going to call up Tom Powers, Joel, is it LaFollette? Kelly LaFollette? I hope I'm getting these right. Denise Fletcher and Sherry Rose, and if we can get some chairs, we'll make sure everybody can come up here and feel comfortable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, we thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about this important bill. My name is Tom Powers. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. The folks that are sitting here will be telling their own stories about how this bill will affect them and affect others in their situation. But before doing that, I wanted to provide a brief overview of how this bill would work prospectively looking ahead. What this bill does is strike an important compromise balance between the interest of injured Oregonians, Oregonian consumers who have been injured by defective products, and balancing the interest of Oregon businesses and manufacturers in these tough economic times. The key provision of this bill is Section 2B. It's been what's referred to as the look-away. It's called the look-away provision because if an Oregonian is injured by a defective product, that person looks to the law of the state where the product was manufactured or to the law of the state where a overseas product was imported in order to establish the repose period that applies to that product. Current law, you have 8 years from the time the product is manufactured. For the teachers that are here today, you'll hear that the product that hurt them was made 15 years ago, so they don't have a cause of action unless this bill is passed, and people who are in the same situation in the future will not have a remedy and any chance at compensation for their injuries. Oregon law would go from 8 years to 10 years. Again, if the product is made overseas or in a different state, one looks away to the repose period that would apply in that state. By doing that, we restore Oregonians to a level playing field. Right now, the law effectively discriminates against Oregonians who are injured by defective products by depriving them, in most instances, of the same opportunity to seek relief that the citizens of the state in which the product was manufactured have. That's an unfair treatment of injured Oregonians that this law remedies. And as I said, it does it in a way by protecting Oregon businesses, limiting the extended repose period to 10 years, a slight expansion from the 8. Now, just just as important as what this law does is what it does not do. First, what it does not do is affect the statute of limitations. This body in 2003 did amendments to the statute of limitations that gives people 2 years from the date that they're injured and learn about their injury and what might have caused it to bring a cause of action. That remains unchanged, and nothing about the case that an injured person would need to prove in court changes either. The only thing that changes is the age of the product under this law. And then critically, what this does not do, in addition to not affecting the law that already governs how you conduct the claims, is that it does not unfairly discriminate amongst Oregonians or among manufacturers. And let me talk about that for just a second. One might hear the argument, for example, that if a product is made overseas, say three products made in a foreign country, and are imported into the United States through three different states, and they end up in Oregon and three different Oregonians are injured by those products, those three injured Oregonians might have to use three different state laws to find the applicable repose period. Well, that does mean that the Oregonians are being treated differently, one as to the other. But in every single instance, the difference is that they will be treated better than they are being treated under the current law. So that's a difference that is fair, and that's a difference in treatment that Oregon consumers can live with. Finally, you might also hear argument that the manufacturer of those products is somehow being arbitrarily discriminated against because the laws of different states might apply. Well, of course, as we sit here today, that is the case for every overseas manufacturer. Under our federal system, the 50 states write their laws, govern the courts within their borders, and as long as that's the case, there will be differences in state law, but those differences in state law are fair, they're constitutional, and they're the same differences in state law that every single one of the manufacturers sees as we sit here today without this being passed. So again, this strikes a balance. It's a compromise between civil justice, protecting the rights of consumers, protecting Oregon businesses, and creating a level playing field for Oregonians like the ones you're about to hear from who've been injured by defective products. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever is next.
My name is Joel Pollitt from Westland, Oregon. My wife, Kelly, is...
Try to get the mic a little closer. Thank you.
My wife, Kelly, is one of the teachers that was injured in the incident in Lake Oswego about 4.5 years ago. I'm sure most of you are aware of what happened in that school gymnasium on that day. If you are not, three of the women here and two others were burned by radiation exposure that exceeded an average daily dose of 41 days in 5.5 hours. I've included in my written testimony today a copy of some medical information, and on the back of it you'll see an image, a confocal image of Kelly's eye and a healthy eye. And you can actually see what the damage was. Since this accident, our efforts have been to prevent it from happening to others. And you were very helpful in that by passing a law last session to remove these lights from Oregon schools, Oregon public schools. These lights are still used in other venues throughout the state and throughout the United States. Most recently, in Tampa, Florida, in a school gymnasium, more people were injured by one of these lights. In fact, the doctor and ended up calling the fire department thinking their home was on fire because they had halo vision from the burns to their eyes. This was a physician that did not know what had happened to him. Now, they will get better. Their exposure was a lot less than what these women here received. But we have a lot of work to do to get the word out about this danger. The fact is, if the light that injured these women had been brand spanking new 1 month prior to the accident, the exact same thing would have happened. The current SOUR law requires that we prove when that light was purchased and put into service, and the only date that we had for that light bulb was 16 years prior to the accident. We don't keep the receipts for a light bulb that's owned by the school gymnasium. It's not our responsibility. How can we provide that information? by changing the current SOAR law, hopefully others that have found themselves in this situation will find a way to seek their day in court or get their day in court. We have been denied that to this point. Why should the state of Oregon be responsible for, through their workers' compensation insurance, be responsible for my wife's medical bills for the rest of her life, which will exceed, on average, $20,000 a year? And why should companies that produce defective products be allowed refuge in the state of Oregon? This was a defective design. The bulb was functioning as it was designed to function when it injured these women. It was designed to keep on burning even after the safety glass had been broken. I would ask that you support Senate Bill 2484. Excuse me, 284B. It will allow us to get our day in court. It will allow us to make these lights a liability for the manufacturer. It will allow us to hopefully remove these lights from the marketplace. And it will no longer allow a refuge in the state of Oregon for manufacturers of defective products.
Chairman Roblin and the committee, first of all, thank you for tolerating Laura Lights for us.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Kelly LaFollett. I'm a teacher in Lake Oswego, and I live in West Lynn. All I did was go to school one day, and my life has forever changed. Much like you got up this morning, I packed my husband lunch, got ready for school, headed out the door, and I've never been the same since. I sat in a gym for a teacher and service training beneath a broken metal halide knife that was defective, and I received 5 hours and 20 minutes of radiation that was equal to 41 consecutive days. Prior to this, I had a very active life. I've taught for 25 years so proudly in the state of Oregon. I've been a state of Oregon mentor teacher. I have national teaching awards. I've completed a marathon. I have summited a mountain. I've spent my time outdoors with my family. And those things are kind of a distant memory for me right now. You can see the accommodations we need just to physically be in the room with you today. I didn't do anything wrong. I was at my job doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And then came the surprises. Surprise number one, I had no idea you could get hurt by a light bulb. That was a room of between 80 and 120 college-educated people, and we had no idea we were sitting there being burned. And no idea it was even ever a possibility. Then I have to tell you, surprise two came along. And that was after this happened and after the extent of our injuries and damage was known. We were denied by the state of Oregon the opportunity to have our case heard by a jury of our peers. We weren't even given the right. What a surprise. I have to tell you, that was. I thought everybody had that right. And it was simply because we didn't have a receipt for how old a light bulb was and when it was put in session. Do you keep your light bulb receipts for more than 5 years? Most of us, I don't think, do. From here, I have choices about how I can spend the rest of my life. I can be angry. I can feel sorry for myself. And I choose not to be there. I choose to find as much joy in my days as I can, and I'm choosing right now to make as much good as can be humanly made out of this situation. And part of that came in 2007 when we worked with all of you, and you overwhelmingly passed a law banning these lights to ever be used again in Oregon public schools. And I can't tell you how thankful I am for that. And now I'm asking you to look at part two and say, you know what? Sometimes people are doing the right thing at the right place at the right time, and it still goes wrong. And when it does, those Oregonians deserve a right to have their day in court, a right to be heard. This isn't about just us. This is about all Oregonians and anything you may face. I never thought I would be in a situation like this. I never thought a light bulb would forever change my life. I left that morning for work just like you did this morning. I ask you to help continue to make some good come from this by protecting Oregonians and when they have been in the right place and doing the right thing, and something as horrible as this has happened, no matter what it is, let them have the right to have their day in court. Let them be heard by a jury, their peers. You don't have to decide the decision yourselves. Just let us have the right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Denise Fletter. I'd like to say I'm also a teacher in Lake Oswego. I'll explain why I say I'd like to in a minute. And I live in Westland as well. My life was changed dramatically that day. I echo everything that Joel and Kelly have said. I have a new normal in my life, and my new normal is a constant pain, 24 hours a day, day and night. It wakes me up at night, and it is all day. Everything I do involves a choice, because every activity costs me some level of increased pain. Teaching, which was my calling, is part of who I am. It wasn't just a job for me. It caused me so much pain that it was costing me my family, my husband, my three children. I have a 16-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 5-year-old. Have paid the price of this. It seems like my family are the only ones that have paid a price. Being in school, being under the fluorescent lights, reading, looking at a computer, and so many other factors would cause me so much pain that I would usually come home with increased eye burning and migraine headaches, to the point where I was nauseous by the time I got home, which meant I could do nothing with my own three children when I got there. So now I've lost that career that brought me so much joy and success, because the doctors finally told me at the end of January that I had to stop teaching. I'm trying to prevent any more damage, I guess, and to try to restore some quality of life with my family. But I still pay the price, even though I'm not teaching right now. Any activity that I choose to do, like with my children, will cost me. Reading to my children, which is one of my greatest joys, I have to let go often. Reading to the younger ones often has to go to my older child or my husband. And I would always read the same book that my older daughter was reading, and we would discuss it at length, and it was one of my joys, sitting with her and talking about these books, and I can't do that anymore. Any other activity, going to one of their sports games or swim meets or camping with them, all of this has changed. And lastly, my financial future is at risk. I'm the one that provides our health benefits, and if I can't go back to work next year, I have no idea what will happen. And nobody has had to be accountable for any of this because of an Oregon law that prevents us from trying to have our day in court. So I cannot urge you enough to give all Oregon citizens the power to hold manufacturers of these dangerous products accountable. Almost every other state in the country would allow us our constitutional right to seek justice, and Oregon is one of the few that doesn't. And I truly believe that that needs to change, which is why I'm here to urge you to support Bill 284B. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Actually, we need it.
Because it goes on the record.
Recording, sorry. Chairman Roblin and committee members, my name is Cheryl Rhodes, and I am also a teacher. I was a PE teacher in the building, and the stories are all the same. I mean, everything has changed in our families. I am submitting written testimony because I know you are on a tight schedule today, so I have submitted my testimony in written form, and I am urging you, please, support Senate Bill 284B. give everybody a chance. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel from anyone? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we'll have Tom Holt, J.L. Wilson, and Josh Palmer.
Chair Roebling and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you about this bill. We understand that these are very difficult issues, as you just heard from the prior panel. That said, our belief is that the products liability statute's objective ought to be to strike a fair balance between the risk for the manufacturer and making sure that those who use the products can seek relief when they are hurt by a product. This bill, however, we think creates more problems than what it solves. You'll be hearing about the business impact, and in the next panel you'll hear about constitutional issues that we see in the bill. I'd just like to highlight a couple of key things. One, the outer limit in the bill is a hard 10 years. There is not, as we read it, there is not an additional 2 years beyond the 10. If you look at the bottom of page 1, it says at line 21, subject to the limitation imposed by subsection 2, and then subsection 2 is 10 years. So someone who is injured and has a legitimate case, but they discover that injury in the ninth year in the 11th month, well, they're out of luck unless they can get the action put together by the end of that month. The present statute has an 8 years plus 2 years. So if you're injured in the seventh year and the 11th month, you still have 2 years to bring the legal action. And we think that kind of construction is appropriate. The look-away provision that you've heard about, we think, poses some great unfairness as well as legal question. I'll just highlight two things. One, we do not think it's good policy for the Oregon legislature to delegate its authority to that of 49 other state legislatures and what they may have done already or what they may do in the future, which you cannot know at this point. And secondly, it does not bring predictability for manufacturers that they need in order to be able to have appropriate liability coverage and do what they need to do financially. So with that, I'll close and turn it over to the other panelists.
Okay. So I'll take the baton. Chair Roebling and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Josh Palmer. I'm an associate general counsel at now called Daimler Trucks North America. Some of you probably know us as our old name, Freightliner LLC. We've been around in the Portland area for more than 60, almost 70 years, I believe. We are headquartered here in Portland. We've got production here in Portland, in North Carolina, in South Carolina, and in Mexico. So, again, when we talk about some of the specifics of this bill and looking to other states and products manufactured outside of the U.S., then this bill has direct impacts on the products that we build and sell throughout the United States. We're the largest commercial vehicle manufacturer in the United States, notwithstanding the market downturns. I think I can still say that. I realize we've got a full house here, so I'm going to try to be as short as I can. I'm going to limit my comments really to two particular areas. They don't really relate to each other. But first one is talk about the bill as written, how it can very well lead to irresolvable conflicts in sort of any run-of-the-mill product liability case. And I'll talk very briefly about a real live case and how and try to show you how that could happen. So I'll talk a little bit about the substance of the bill. I'm not going to touch on the constitutionality. I think somebody else is going to take that one. And then secondly, I want to talk about the very real impacts to my company and to all Oregon manufacturers. I don't think there's any doubt this is going to increase litigation. Nobody certainly can argue with that, and so I want to talk about what that's going to mean to my company. First, let me elaborate a little bit about the text or the substance of the bill as written and some potential grave problems, in my opinion, as far as the applicability. We've talked a little bit about this so-called look-away provision, and really what that's potentially going to do is look to the statutes of repose in states other than Oregon where the product, and that's the buzzword of the, used in the statute, is manufactured. And if it's the case, if it's a foreign manufactured product, where the product is distributed. So that's when you talk about a product liability lawsuit involving one product, that's not a difficult analysis, right? But in any number of products that Freightliner manufactures or that one of our subsidiaries manufactures, you could be talking about 5, 6, 7 different products involved in one lawsuit. And what I mean by that is we may be the final assembler or manufacturer of a school bus, of a heavy truck, of a medium-duty truck. And as part of that, we are sourcing components for that product from any number of manufacturers throughout the United States. In any given product liability lawsuit, the plaintiff may allege defects with not just the final product, the final truck or the final school bus, as the case may be, but also any number of different components that were assembled into that product. So I've got a lawsuit, a complaint in front of me. It's about 135 pages here. It's a pretty hefty one, where, and it's not pending here in Oregon, but I'm just using this to underscore my point, where the plaintiffs have named, in addition to Freightliner and Thomas Built Buses, which is one of our subsidiaries, they've named, and it involves a school bus, they've named Bendix Commercial Vehicle Systems, which I believe makes some of the braking componentry. That's the product too, right? They've named Cummins Americas, Inc., which is the engine manufacturer, another product. They've named Allison Transmission, which makes the made the transmission. They've named Dana Corporation, which made the axles in this product. And they've named Parker Hannifin Corporation, which I think made some of the brake lines. Those are all products. As I interpret this statute, and as this statute, I believe, would be applied, I can tell you that those 6 or 7 products are manufactured all over the country, and presumably with different statutes of repose that would be applicable. So I have no idea how under this statute one would resolve that conflict. I think that's an irreconcilable conflict on the face of this statute, and certainly is a problem, I think, right out of the box in terms of the substance of this statute. Moving on to the impact to my company, again, I can't sit here and tell you how much more litigation Daimler Trucks North America would have to deal with as a result of this dramatic expansion of the statute of repose. I'd be lying to you if I tried to bake up some numbers. I can tell you it will have an impact. We will have extra increased litigation as a result of this, as will every other substantial manufacturer in this state. I think there is no doubt about that. And all you need is, frankly, is a couple cases like this one, the one I was telling you about, where the plaintiff's demand is $100 million to each defendant, to conclude fairly readily that this is a real, not imagined impact to a company that's been in this state and in Portland for almost 70 years, who employs people like you and me and other folks like the people in this gallery. So that impact is real to us, and it will increase our defense costs. It will necessarily increase our insurance costs. And again, this is a real, not theoretical, adverse impact to my company at a time when we've been in a downturn in the trucking industry now since the beginning of 2007. And, you know, today GM announced its bankruptcy. Monaco's gone, I believe, went bankrupt. Country Coach went bankrupt. The motor vehicle industry is being ravaged right now, and I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is not the time to be looking to pass a bill with the sort of impacts that will necessarily occur as a result of this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. We represent the bulk of Oregon manufacturers. Of concern to us is the impact of this bill on Oregon manufacturing. It's been said that this bill strikes a balance. We do not believe this bill strikes a balance, particularly the look-away provision. We believe current law is the balance that was struck some years ago, and in my written testimony I'll have some summary from a Supreme Court justice outlining the bargaining and the give and take that took shape to create this specific law. Oregon manufacturing, we've concluded, will be harmed by passage of Senate Bill 284. Oregon manufacturers that import parts from other states where the parts were manufactured in other states or imported in other states now will be open to lawsuits and claims based on an extended statute of repose because we're giving deference to the statute of repose in other states. So this opens the door wide open for lawsuits on Oregon manufacturers based on statutes of repose in other states. We don't think that that's a fair scenario. Where there is certainty now in terms of litigation, Senate Bill 284 creates a high level of uncertainty, especially with regard to exposure to claims. Where there's stability and predictability in rates, and now there's unpredictability and instability, creating what we feel is an unjustifiable economic stress, particularly at the worst possible time right now in our economic climate. And I don't think that we could pass 284 and expect that Oregon jobs, Oregon family wage jobs in the manufacturing sector would not be lost as a result. And I don't think that now's the time to go down that road. So we do oppose the look-away provision, and for that reason, oppose Senate Bill 284 as it currently stands before you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. I noticed, gentlemen, in your testimony here, you say that only Nebraska has a look-away. How long have they had it, and what has been their experience with it?
Chair Roland, Representative Berger, my understanding is that the Nebraska is the only other state that has something like this and that it's been in force for just a handful of years. And I do not know what the litigation history is on it. Perhaps Mr. Palmer could.
Representative Edwards.
Pass.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel?
Right.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, gentlemen. My heart bleeds for the multi-million dollar corporations that are here in opposition to this. Who's got a little bit of heart to bleed for those who are sitting in the audience that have been affected by this? Mr. Chair, I have to admit I'm not the least bit sympathetic with this. This is the third session where this issue of ultimate repose has come up. It came up in previous session in relationship to previous sessions in relationship to Vioxx, and only after I made a fool of myself in my own caucus meeting, stomping on the table, getting up and stomping on the table, did I get my caucus members to go back and bring that back in an attempt to deal with it in relationship to one component, one manufacturer. Mr. Chair, I hope we can find a solution here that will get real as far as this particular issue is concerned.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you all for being here. We'll call Jim Gardner, looks like Arvin Dayton, and John Powell.
For the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm general counsel with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and my testimony will be brief and on a narrow issue. The hospitals and others, but I speak on their behalf, are concerned about the constitutionality of the look-away provision that's in the latest version of Senate Bill 284. Essentially, we think that the look-away provision that allows the law of another state to control Oregon activity is a violation of the delegation provision in the Oregon Constitution. The Oregon Constitution reserves to you the ability to make the laws of the state. And it does not allow you to cede that ability to someone else. And the way the law is written, it says that the statute of repose that will be applied to a particular litigation around a particular product will be the law of the state in which that product is manufactured or the state in which it is imported. So that means that if another state, Washington is as good an example as any, has a different statute of repose than we do, that law will apply, but worse yet, constitutionally, if Washington decides to change that law, in a few years they say, let's say it's 10 years. They say, well, we think it's appropriate to make that longer. Let's make that 15 years. That's the right public policy for Washington. That law would apply, that 15 years on the face of this statute would apply to Oregon litigation around a product that was manufactured or imported into Washington. And that is allowing the state of Washington to tell us what our law will be, and that's not something that we can do. Now, the way this law would be interpreted would be that, okay, despite the fact that on the face of it, it says the law of Washington would apply, we're only going to apply the law of our example state, Washington, as it existed on the day this law was passed. Because we are allowed to decide that that statute of repose they've got today is a good one. We can make that decision, or you can. But the problem is that that's not the way the law is actually written on the page. When somebody reads this in the statute books a few years from now, it doesn't say effective date of this act. It requires the litigants in the case to understand that, or the court in which they bring their case to make that kind of a ruling. So on its face, this law is unconstitutional. It could be interpreted in a constitutional way, but that requires that extra step on the part of the litigants and on the part of the court in which the case is brought. We also just don't think that this look-away provision really presents very good public policy for the state. When I walked in, I heard the first presenter talk about how it's fair for manufacturers to have different statutes of repose apply to different products, as they're used to, essentially complying with laws of different states. But in my mind, I think of the Oregonian and what's fair for them, because from the way this law is written, a person who brings a case based on a product manufactured in one state has a different statute of repose than a person who brings a case based on the same product that might be manufactured in another state would have a different length of time that would apply. And we're not sure if that's really the kind of law we'd like to have in the state, and our concern on that basis as well. And I invite any questions that you might have.
Thank you. We'll go through the panel, and then we'll come back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent several insurers. I've been contacted by legal counsel from those companies questioning really the issue that Ms. Gwen Dayton just raised, the constitutionality of that, and from an insurance standpoint, they believe it will cause a lot of litigation. Also, I just note from being in this building for a long time, there is precedent for dealing with egregious situations as was presented to you earlier. The one that comes to mind is the Chevy side saddle gas tanks. There have been other issues as well where the legislature has intervened to set those issues back and give some retroactivity to the plaintiffs involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Pharma. And I want to just begin by saying I have a long history on this issue in this building, as some of you may know. A few sessions ago, when a case called Gladhart was handed down, the Supreme Court essentially collapsed the two-year statute of limitations and the statute of repose. And in the reading of many, that had the effect of imposing what amounted to a flat two-year statute of repose. And we were honored and privileged to work hand in glove with the plaintiff's trial bar to remedy that situation in a bill that was helped to design by then Chair Max Williams of the House Judiciary Committee. This issue has resurfaced periodically. As Representative Jensen mentioned, the Vioxx issue came up last session, and thanks to his diligence, that issue resulted in a carve-out, one of the carve-outs similar to what John Powell was referring to. And last session, at least most of the business community, put on the table an offer not for a 10-year statute, but for a 14-year statute of repose and a carve-out for the light bulb injuries. That offer was rejected by the trial lawyers. Flat out rejected. No negotiation, no discussion, no interest, unfortunately. Now, Gwen has talked about the delegation issue, that the constitutional problem that that raises, which I can assure you is very serious and probably will be the subject of a challenge if you pass the bill in this form. There's another issue that is even more unfair from my perspective. It's discussed in my memo, and I'll just quickly summarize it. And it has to do with imports. Let's say imports of toasters from China. The amount of time that a individual Oregonian will have to sue for a defect in that toaster, identical toasters made in the same plant, in the same factory in China, will depend arbitrarily on whether that toaster is in a container that comes in through, let's say, the Port of Long Beach, Port of Portland, or Port of Seattle. Each of those will have different statutes of repose. That's not the kind of uniformity I think we should strive for in our law. The statute of repose is intended to give certainty, uniformity, all of the things that you heard about are so important to the business community in the Freightliner testimony. I just want to leave you with a thought. If you're going to reform this bill, if you're going to change it, there's a heck of a lot better way to do it than to cobble together this approach.
Representative Burke.
Thank you. I'll ask you the same question I had of the other folks. Has anybody looked at Nebraska, if they had a constitution? And I know they have a different constitution, but have there been, I'm sure theirs is not that unlike Oregon's, has there been a constitutional challenge to the law in Nebraska? The look away provision?
Representative Berger, we'll research that for you. I think it's too soon for that to have happened, but we'll research that for you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Other questions of this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. That is the entire list of people who were signed up on Senate Bill 284A. So I'm going to close the public hearing. And I anticipate that we will carry over the work session to tomorrow. So, and also a reminder that Rules is going to start meeting daily this week since we have...
Same time.
I've been trying to get it earlier. If I can work out a schedule that everybody here isn't in a Ways and Means Committee at a different time, we'll try to get it earlier. But right now it'll be 3 to 5. Okay.
Can't do it.
I know. We'll have some conflicts. Yeah. You're on all these committees that go away.
Well, we'll have conflicts on morning hours.
Yes, that's what we heard. We heard there were conflicts everywhere. When it came to revenue and ways and means, we were in trouble not to be here.
I understand that after 5 o'clock, there's even another conflict.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So we do have an agenda for tomorrow, or we're just carrying over?
We will probably post it shortly, if we haven't already. Did we post to a tomorrow calendar yet?
No.
We have not, so we will post it. We'll carry over some bills here today, and then we'll post some others. The Senate bills that are coming over to us, we are now in the process of, as they get here, posting them. As you know, currently the hope was that we would be done in Rules by the 8th, which is a week from tomorrow. So there's a lot to do between now and then. And we seem to have trouble getting all the amendments ready for these other bills. So. And also just to let people know, because our agenda is very thick and we are starting to move each day, we are we have not gotten the paperwork on 2600, so we'll carry that bill over. And 3100, we're not going to get to today. Don't know if it'll be up tomorrow. We'll let you know shortly on that one. Okay. So we're going to open one that we've been carrying over for a long time. House Bill 3240. Did we close the public hearing? We did, didn't we? Yeah. We're going to open a public hearing on 3240. We'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3240 requires expense of any postage for ballots returned by mail that exceeds the expense of postage for mail that weighs 1 ounce or less to be apportioned between the Secretary of State and county as a cost of elections. It requires the Secretary of State to reimburse each county clerk for necessary expenses relating to state measures and state offices included on the ballot in a primary and general election. requires the Secretary of State to designate by rule a formula for apportionment of the expense of such postage. The Dash 2 amendments remove the requirement from the printed bill that the state pay an apportioned share of excess postage on ballots. It allows counties the option to pay for all or part of ballots mailed to a county that exceed the cost of postage for mailing of 1 ounce or less. Specifies that counties should notify the public of the excess cost of postage for mail weighing more than 1 ounce. Takes effect on January 1, 2013. You also have a proposed Dash 4 set of amendments that affects ORS 254.046 by specifying that all expenses incurred for a city election shall be paid by the city and requires the Secretary of State to designate a formula for apportionment of expenses. Currently, only special elections held by a city must be paid for by the city. We have both a fiscal and revenue on the Dash 2 amendments. No revenue impact. And minimal expenditure impact. We have no fiscal revenue on the Dash 4.
Okay. So with that, we'll call up Annette Newingham, Tim Scott, and Barry Pack. And I think we have all the amendments we're going to get now. So after we get done hearing, that's when we will have a work session on this bill and figure out where we're going to go from there. So,
For the record, I'm Annette Newingham for Lane County Clerk, here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I am here to support House Bill 3240, in particular the Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments. The key benefits to this is that the counties would be reimbursed for the state and city election costs for all elections with state offices and or measures effective January 1, 2013. And currently, the state and the cities do not reimburse for their portion for the primary and the general election costs, and this does follow the recommendation of the Federal Forest Payments Task Force that the state should pick up within a reasonable amount of time for the elections that are currently paid by the counties. Also, the portion of the bill, the governing body of each county would have the statutory authority to be able to pay for the postage expense in excess of 1 ounce postage on return voted ballots for those rare occasions. And there's a minimal fiscal impact to that because it isn't frequent that postage on voted ballots exceed 1 ounce. There is an exception. And a large portion of the ballots returned are not mailed back. They're actually dropped off at the official drop site locations. An example, Lane County, which did exceed, we had 80% of our ballots were returned at our official drop site, so only 20% were mailed back. The majority of counties already make an arrangement with the U.S. Post Office to ensure delivery of ballots to county election offices that exceed. So this will give us statutory authority to do that. If postage costs do exceed first-class postage, each county should make a good faith effort, and we certainly support that, and we already do that. We do press releases. We put information on our websites. We put it on the ballot, and we do what we can to inform people. So we're in complete support of that provision in this bill. And the current method of determining the apportioned election costs would work with the Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments and would not require a complicated method in order to determine this, the occasional exceeding and splitting that between the state and the county. We felt that was not a really good idea. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify today, and I'll welcome any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, Tim Scott, Director of Elections for Multnomah County. And I am testifying in behalf of Multnomah County in support of House Bill 3240 and the Dash 2 amendments. As Annette talked about, the postage issue is one that comes up infrequently, but when it does come up, it's difficult for us as county elections officials to deal with since there is no statutory ability for us to smooth that road. and the dash twos of the, there was a dash one and a dash three, and the dash twos were the choice of the clerks throughout the state. And this committee has also has already had quite a discussion on the issue of election billing, both on this bill and House Bill 3107 related to special district billing. And what I've heard of this discussion makes me believe that there is a realization that this issue needs to be addressed, but that now may not be the time. The Dash 2s also pushes the effective date out to 2013 to give the state time to address how they will come up with the money to fund their share of the general and primary elections. At this time, Multnomah County is not taking a position on the Dash 4 amendments, but is open to discussion with the cities within Multnomah County should that time arise. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pat. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, every day that this bill got held over, my testimony got shorter, so I'm going to be very brief. our main concern with this bill, or our main interest in this bill, actually, is providing counties the statutory authority to pay for the postage in excess of 1 ounce. When that happens, we think it's important that we take care of that in the statute so they're not at any risk in the future. As for the cost of elections, obviously it will come to a cost to the state in 2013 if this bill passes, and I would just say that if it hurts to rip off a Band-Aid today, it's going to hurt to rip off a Band-Aid tomorrow and in 4 years, but maybe 4 years gives you some time to prepare for that pain that's going to come. And that finally, it's our intention to try and bring all of the various stakeholders together during the interim, regardless of whether this bill moves forward all the way through the process or not, bring the cities, counties, districts, and the state to the table and see if we can't all come to some sort of recommendation on how we might implement a new way of apportioning costs between all of the municipalities that share a ballot. And we will be bringing that to you in 2010, should you be here, or 2011. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Garrard.
If, and anyone is that's capable of answering, do we have a an idea on the fiscal, if this goes into effect in 2010?
I can give a general, and then you can comment specific to the state. The overall, we're currently, it was over $8 million statewide for both the primary and general election, all costs. That's what the county pays, the state, and the districts, whoever pays any cost, the overall for the primary and the general election. 60% of that cost the county is currently covering. That's of all those millions of dollars statewide. And about 25% of all the costs are for the state and the cities of that total amount that we cover for them. Our portion for this county is, I think, is about 25 to 30%. But I think that AOC also has some figures, and they may be able to firm that up a little bit better. Thank you.
Chair Roebling, Representative Garrard, just for the state's portion, obviously, it varies by election, how many ballot measures are on, how many statewide races, et cetera, are on there. But we took a look at the percentage of a ballot that is either a state office or a statewide measure, and that ranged between 60% and 74% of the ballot. So if that were state races, so if you just use that to apportion the cost, in 2008, we'd be looking at about $5.5 million would have been the state's cost.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
Now, the Dash 4s, we really don't have a fiscal because it'll be 2013 before it commences. Is that correct?
No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, yes.
Dash 2s and Dash 4s.
Right, both of them, yeah.
Both dash twos and dash fours. We will not have a fiscal on either one before we vote on this bill, even though we just have an estimate from Mr. Pack of.
We do have a Ways and Means referral. It is going to go to Ways and Means for exactly that reason.
Oh, whoopee, Arnie.
They have asked for this bill, even if it didn't have. They want to anticipate in the future. So.
Okay. My response based on that, I'm on Ways and Means.
I know. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Ann Hannes, Alex Kyler, and Andrea Fogg. Oh, Brenda Wilson. And we can have three, and I think we still have two others left to go after that.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. As you've heard, House Bill 3240 in its original form addresses the costs associated with postage for election ballots that exceed 1 ounce. It also includes a section about having the state pay its share of election costs, and this is consistent, as I've testified before, on the recommendations of the Federal Forest Payments Task Force. There is an amendment, dash twos, that would extend the start of the repayment to 2013, and we're supportive of that. We do believe that it's important that all entities, counties, special districts, schools, cities, and the state should eventually pay the share in costs of elections. And determining that is sometimes a difficult thing to do, given the share of how the elections are and depending on the measures. We would support the Secretary of State's proposal to convene a work group on election apportionment with the goal of coming back with a legislative proposal for phasing in election costs for cities, but we urge especially for the state to pay its share beginning in 2013. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. And you've got my testimony before you. For the record, Lane County is supportive of House Bill 3240. We do believe that the dash twos and the dash fours do make it a better bill. In looking at this issue, I actually went down to the Archives Division and pulled out, because I kept seeing in statute reference to the laws that were passed in the 1979 session. And sure enough, I brought out the Senate bill that had them bring out the Senate bill that addressed elections reform in 1979. They had to bring it out on a cart because of all the boxes that were involved. And the amount of time that I had and the expertise that I have in terms of elections law, I didn't really get through everything there. So I can't speak to the ins and outs of what happened in 1979. But clearly, there was a major reform of elections law in 1979, you could see in 1979, from what I understand of counties and Lane County in particular, pretty good years for counties back then. But since that time, we've had a number of things that have happened. The downturn in the timber economy, the property tax limitation measures, are dancing around with secure rural schools reauthorization. And unfortunately, counties are just not in the position to be able to fund the expenses that are involved with a number of core services. And so before you have a very difficult decision to make about how those core services should be funded. One way is that counties can fee their intergovernmental partners to participate in those things, and that may be really not the best solution to the structural problem, and that's what my testimony gets to at the end, is that the structural problem, in our opinion, is a reform of property tax laws that ironically will take a vote of the people and that the counties will hold that election. But you know, what I think you have before you is really an intermediate solution to a structural problem that is provided to you in House Bill 3240 with the amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. The League does not have a position on House Bill 3240. We are neutral on the bill. However, the dash four amendments before you, we oppose. There has been no dialogue with cities to this point about what it would mean to include us in terms of reapportioning of elections costs. What we do know is that this would be a very significant cost shift, one, as Mr. Kyler alluded to, that is part of a larger systemic issue, not just election costs. Before you this session have been other discussions about cost shifts. So we think that this discussion needs very careful consideration. There are many, many unanswered questions, complex issues that we just don't have the answers for. We don't know how this would work to reapportion these costs to cities. And so we would ask that, respectfully, we understand that there was a recommendation from a task force to include the state in 2013. Cities were not a part of that recommendation. We think that all parties need to come to the table in the interim and really work through these issues to understand what the cost shift would mean, what's appropriate in terms of these core providers of services. And so we would ask that we have that discussion in the interim. As we have committed to this committee before, the League will come to the table in all earnest and work through these issues in the interim. And then we'd like to come back to you with a specific recommendation so we understand exactly what we're dealing with. So at this point in time, the League would ask your no vote on the Dash 4 amendments and that we have the opportunity to sit down over the interim and address these issues.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, we have Brenda Wilson and David Lomberg.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Governmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. And as with the League of Oregon Cities, the City of Eugene does not have a position on the bill as originally drafted. However, we are opposed to the Dash 4 amendments, which would pull cities in to be part of the reapportionment of costs. And we aren't opposed to that as a principle. We are opposed to that because we have not been involved in any discussion as to how that would work or how it would impact our city. We certainly understand firsthand what the counties are going through. The City of Eugene is facing a $12 million budget shortfall for fiscal year 2010. Our city manager has just taken 4 days off without pay, which will become a common theme in our city. Many staff people are doing that to try to fill in that budget gap. And we've been working with Lane County and partnering for creative solutions in order to help them with their shortfall in their budget, especially where they provide core services that impact the City of Eugene as well. We would like to have that conversation with them as a broader conversation because the reapportionment of elections cost isn't going to do it. We need to talk about how we can better partner with our county to make sure that all core services are covered. We fully intend to be a good partner in that conversation. We haven't had the opportunity to have that conversation with our county. And so I'll limit my testimony to that and pass it on to Mr. Barenberg.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg from the Government Relations Office of the City of Portland. I would like to echo the remarks of Ms. Wilson and Ms. Vogue on this bill. The City of Portland has been engaged in an ongoing process with Multnomah County about how we fund services and how we can share in funding of services. One of the most fruitful resolutions recently has been regarding the Selwood Bridge, to which the City of Portland has committed millions of dollars in funding for what is a county facility, but it's something that clearly serves the citizens of the city, the county, and they expect government to get it done. We're having those discussions. We're addressing those issues at a local level, and we were a little surprised at the genesis of this to bring cities into what has been a differing discussion that had been ongoing over the interim but hadn't involved cities. We too would be pleased to engage in a discussion about this over the interim. We too are facing budgetary issues that are requiring reductions in staff and other significant service reductions. So we too would urge your not to move the Dash 4 amendments and do not have a position on the rest of the bill. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? Representative Edwards.
I think we're getting close to the end of the testimony, so I did want to, for the benefit of everybody here, just another time that Representative Edwards agrees with our good friends at the League of Cities. I haven't involved the League of Cities in the discussions about this bill because it has never been my intention via the Dash 4s. The Dash 4s are not my amendments to bring the cities in. So it's always been my intention from the beginning for this to be a state-county bill. And when we first heard it, I believe Representative Berger has a different view on this and spoke to that. So,
Representative Berger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, are we near the end of testimony?
We are.
Okay. I totally agree with the city. They shouldn't be paying, and neither should the state. It's a county function. It has been a county function for a long time. And while I sympathize that the counties have got, you know, funding problems, when school districts had funding problems, we sent the bill to the state. When we have prison problems, jail problems, the bill ends up with the state. We're just moving the money around here, friends. Make no mistake, the bill will have to be paid. Whether it's 2013 or tomorrow, somebody has to pay for the cost of elections. I have put forward the dash fours because if we are going to apportion, let's get everybody at the table. If we move forward without everybody at the table, then the discussion will go forward when we'll hear more of this. Well, we weren't there. We didn't hear. We weren't at the table. I say get everybody at the table in this bill. And for my community, and I'm a big fan of local government, the cities have a big piece of the election pie and therefore should be part of the apportionment when we really get there. So, Mr. Chair, I think that the discussion needs to be with all the parties. It needs to be before the bill comes due in 2013 or whatever, and that's why I have prepared the dash four amendments to make sure that 2 years from now when the bill starts to come to bill due, we don't hear this, oh, we haven't been at the table, we haven't been at the discussion again. Other than that, then leave it alone. Let this continue to be a county function, and we just back out and say, tough, county. It's expensive, but it's a core function of the county. Those are sort of the options that I like. So that's why I have moved the dash four amendments. Or I won't move it right away, but give me a chance before we close.
That's right. That's all of the test. Oh, wait, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, would another amendment be in order?
It could be. None right now. We're still in a public hearing.
I was thinking about asking LC for a draft just to do away with the vote by mail, and maybe that would get back to a simpler, less expensive solution.
There are many people who like going to those polling places. There are.
Yeah, I know. I'm one of them.
So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3240. How I could ever forget that name, I don't know. We carried it over enough. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3240. And we already know about the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I'd like to move the dash twos in House Bill 3240.
Representative Edwards moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3240. Discussion. Seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, no objection?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, Representative.
No, go ahead.
Okay. We, the House, that the dash two amendments are approved. So now, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the dash four amendments.
Representative Berger moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 3240.
3240.
Any discussion?
Just to repeat my opposition to the dash fours. I think that I understand philosophically where Representative Berger is coming from. I also happen to think that the dash fours become a poison pill and the whole bill dies as it moves out of this committee. So
I see we have some opposition. We'll take a roll call vote on the dash fours.
Representative Girard?
No.
Representative Gelser?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Yes.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Reed?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
No.
Chair Rowland?
Aye. So it fails.
But I would tell the cities that if this bill goes on, they better start getting involved in the action, because I, along with Representative Berger, agree that everybody needs to be at this table about elections. It's important for all of us. So with that, I'll take a motion on the main bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And we do have the fizz and the riz. We've got all the stuff. Okay. So Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, do not think that my silence when the dash twos were entered means that I'm going to support this bill. I believe that if you don't get the cities to the table now, you will never get there, and I will vote against this bill here and in the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelzer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
Motion passes. So it's off to Ways and Means. We're going to close our work session on 3240. I'm going to open, I hope, the last public hearing on 2853. I'm not sure that people had time to read the amendment, so I'm not sure that I'm going to move it, but I would like to at least get on the record whether we're where we need to be or close to it. So with that, I'll have a short explanation, and you guys can come on up.
Chair Roper, members of the committee, House Bill 2853 expands the prohibition on possession and transferring firearms to include persons found guilty of misdemeanors, except for insanity.
Okay, with that.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. This, for the record, is Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. The bill before you, House Bill 2853, is still before you as a gut and stuff. The Dash 8 amendment is the most current amendment, and I believe it accomplishes what we had set out to do in what I had described to you previously. To refresh your memory, this Dash 8 amendment does not expand any prohibition for the possession or sale of firearms beyond what currently exists. This bill will do two things. It will give specific authorization for the state to report a limited and narrow class of individuals and only their identity, birth date, and minimal information to the federal database that gun dealers check before sales of firearms to determine whether or not those buyers are prohibited under federal law from possessing firearms. There are three categories, and that actually is one of the tweaks that we made since the last time this bill was before you that this covers. That's the reporting side of this bill. The other side of this bill is the relief from the prohibition, from the federal prohibition, that is also required by federal law. This is implementing, or at least partially implementing, federal law that was put into effect after the Virginia Tech tragedy 2 years ago. And I did, in my prior testimony, inadvertently give you one wrong piece of data. I told you that Oregon was one of eight states that was not reporting this mental health information to the federal database, and I was wrong. Oregon is one of 18, not eight states. Still very much in the minority, and still has to be something that we do or risk the loss of federal public safety, some of our federal public safety grants. I'm just going to briefly tell you what the change has been with respect to from the Dash 6, which you last saw, to the Dash 8. We narrowed the class of individuals whose identities would be reported that fall under the civil commitment statute. I told you last time this would apply to three categories: civil commitment, guilty except for insanity, and those found unable to aid and assist in their own defense. And that's still the case, but we narrowed down the civil commitment to two subcategories, only the civil commitments who are specifically found a danger to self or others, or who the court specifically says in its civil commitment order, you are not allowed to carry a firearm. So that is how we've narrowed this down. There were several other non-substantive, I believe, clarifications that were implemented to obtain the neutrality of the National Rifle Association. And I think I will let them speak for themselves if they're going to testify. But I think what you have is a better version of what we intend to bring you.
Ms. Vanda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, David Yandell with the Oregon State Police. I'm not sure that I would add anything to what Mr. Leary has already shared unless you have any specific questions.
Any questions? Yes, there we go. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Mr. Leary, you said there are two things under. Would you go by that a little more slowly? I appreciate your talking fast and getting through and trying to get us out of here before the wee hours of the, but it takes a little bit for this to digest.
Understandable, Chair Roblin and Representative Jensen. The two main things this bill does, one is reporting and the other is relief. Those are my two shorthand words. The reporting refers to the state having authorization to report to the National instant criminal background check database the name, date of birth, and gender of individuals who fit in the class of people who are prohibited under federal law from possessing firearms. One example that's a really easy one is a felon. That's under federal law. You can't possess a firearm. The federal law also uses what in my opinion is an offensive term, a mental defective person is prohibited from possessing a firearm under federal law. That has been interpreted by the Department of or Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to include individuals who have been civilly committed for any reason, individuals found guilty except for insanity or found guilty for by reason of insanity, and individuals who are unable to aid and assist. So that's the reporting part of this bill. It gives the state agencies that have that information the authority to transmit that minimal information to the federal database. The relief portion of the bill provides for the individuals who are not eligible to possess a firearm under federal law because of the mental illness, the ability to petition the court to once again possess firearms.
Yeah, the relief is not, I was interested in the first part.
But we narrowed, you mentioned just now what the federal government wants.
Yes.
But we're not going to give them all of that, right?
Not all of it. The original version of the amendment applied to anyone subject to a civil commitment order. In response to concerns articulated by Representative Gelser, we drilled down on that, and she correctly pointed out that individuals with developmental disabilities who are not necessarily found a danger to self or others, but rather are civilly committed on the basis of not being able to care for their basic personal needs, can be civilly committed without a dangerousness finding. We have carved that population out in the Dash 8 amendment and have limited the civil commitment class only to folks who have been specifically found by the court a danger to self or others, or for whom the court has specifically ordered you are not allowed to possess a firearm.
Okay. Representative Gelser.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Mr. O'Leary. My question was along that line. So a danger to self or others, is that something that's actively more broad than not being able to take care of oneself? So if I'm not able to care for my own needs, am I dangerous to myself?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, with the caveat that it's been 4 years since I actively practiced trial work, and probably even longer since I represented an individual who is allegedly mentally ill in civil commitment court. My recollection of the standard is it is one or the other. And just because an individual, just because a court finds an individual not able to care for their own basic personal needs does not trigger the finding of danger to self or others. And the statute, actually the civil commitment statute, which I hope I have here, is 427.290 for the record, and that is the statute that provides the determination, and it is specific. I'm going to read for you that the person, because of their mental condition, is either dangerous to self or others, or is unable to provide for personal need of the person and is not receiving the care as is necessary for the health, safety, or rehabilitation of the purpose. So it's one or the other.
Representative Gelser, follow up.
Thank you, follow up. And thank you very much for working so hard to address that concern. Could you help relieve my mind a little bit and help me understand what would be an example of something that might occur that, you know, no crime has been committed yet, but a court has determined that a person is dangerous to themselves or others? What does that look like in practice?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, couple of examples. Individual who is engaging in suicidal attempts, conduct. An individual who, I give you an example, very old example from my practice. I represented an individual who was a Vietnam War veteran who was shooting BB guns at the helicopters as they landed near OHSU up on the hill. He was arrested, charged with various crimes, and upon investigation of his circumstances, the criminal charges were dismissed. In lieu of the criminal charges, he stipulated or agreed to a civil commitment on the grounds of dangerous to others, and received treatment in that vein. I think that was one of those cases where the court also affirmatively said, "And you know, you're a danger to self or others, and you shouldn't be possessing a firearm either." So I think those are kind of the two categories. You're either doing something or threaten to do something that is self-harm, or more likely you've engaged in behavior that is places others at risk. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, it is very, in my days of practice, it was very, very difficult to obtain a civil commitment. This is not something that is done capriciously. There really needs to be a severe case in either direction, either dangerousness or the inability to care for one's own personal needs.
Okay, one more follow-up?
One more follow-up.
Thank you. So if, say, I go to purchase a gun and there's another Sarah Gelser out there that has been civilly committed or guilty except for insanity, what is my remedy when I'm there to prove that I am not that person and not be hindered in my effort to purchase a firearm?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, I'm flipping through the bill to look, first of all, at the exact information that would be transmitted, and I would hope that the same Sarah Gelser doesn't have your same birth date, which I think is one of the criteria, and it may be, is gender and race the other? I'm sorry, I'm trying to flip through this very quickly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the three component parts of the minimal information is the name, date of birth, and the sex of the individual. Those are the three pieces of information that the FBI requires.
So if you were unlucky enough to have that match on all three, I don't think this bill actually addresses that situation. I think that would be something that you would have to take up with state police and with the federal database to be able to prove by fingerprints or by some other means that you are the different Sarah Gelser with the same birth date and sex.
1973, it was a good year.
It was a good year.
Okay. Yeah. Any other questions for these panelists?
No questions.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, and thanks for the work that you've done on the bill. You said we had civil commitment, guilty except for insanity, or individuals who are unable to aid and assist.
Yes.
Explain that third one to me. Yes. We spent a lot of time on civil commitment.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, when an individual is charged with a crime, there's a constitutional and statutory requirement, due process constitutional requirement, that that person have the capacity to understand the charges against them, and to, in order to have effective assistance of counsel, must minimally be able to communicate with their counsel and prepare a defense. And you know, with such frequency in the criminal justice system, the intersection between mental illness and the criminal justice system, it is not uncommon to have individuals where you know, they are not able to function, they are not able to communicate because of their mental illness. And if you're in a situation like that, you can ask a court, whether you're the prosecutor or the defense attorney, to have that person evaluated to determine whether or not they are able to aid and assist. The other term is fitness to proceed in the criminal case. And based on, typically based on the recommendation of an evaluating psychologist, the court makes that determination. And if a person is found unfit to proceed, makes usually a commitment decision, either to the Oregon State Hospital or some other facility.
A follow-up.
Follow-up.
Back on the civil commitment criteria, I think you said if they are found to be a danger to self or others, or the court specifically says that they can't carry or own or purchase a firearm. And I think you said if that's found by the court specifically on the danger to self or others. So under this bill, that is the court that makes that determination, or because I thought we were talking about agencies
only
and other.
There's two parts of that.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, it is the court that makes that determination. And it is, again, so we're in the civil commitment bucket. There is a way that the court can say you're a danger to self or others. That information would be reported, not the information itself, but that person would be reported. The court doesn't have to make the finding that you're a danger to self or others, but can, in a mental health civil commitment, say, I'm going to order you not to possess firearms, and that would also be reported.
Right. Okay, so it's not agencies.
It is
making
not.
That
it is,
determination.
It is the court finding.
I assume it's the court working with agencies and
after on the
it's
other part
it's
of the
a
bill.
Court process.
On the other part of the bill,
yeah,
which gives them a chance to get it back. Oftentimes, that's done by an agency group of physicians and others after the 2 years if they require it.
Okay.
Doesn't necessarily go to court. Representative Jensen.
I have some concerns about the. Perhaps looseness of this. Court commitments, I mean, I understand the law specifies pretty carefully what is required for court commitment. And other than a self-commitment, and that isn't, I don't think, addressed here, that is a way, now maybe I'm wrong, maybe, you know, I'd like to be informed about it, but a self-commitment to a state mental institution or private mental institution for that part, you know, because family talks them into it or they talk them something, you know, of that type, be concerned about whether that is a reportable category. And I'd also be concerned, I believe there is, or at least there was, a police officer commitment. And they're temporary commitments, but a police officer can apprehend somebody and rather than shoot them, you know, can take them to, and rather than take them to jail where there's not a necessarily psychiatric help available, can take them to a mental hospital or a private psychiatric facility and put them on, I don't know, some three-day hold or something of that type, if I'm remembering correctly. And give me the particulars. Are those exempt or are they included? It sounds like they're exempt.
Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, I think that I can answer the second part first, which is the concept known as a 48-hour hold that does require, I think, either a doctor or two citizens. And that is only until the court can hold a civil commitment hearing at which the person has a right to counsel to have appointed and a judge makes a decision. So that wouldn't apply to this. And we double-checked with counsel on the self-commitment and have an answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, self-commitments also would not apply.
That strikes me as being a possible dangerous loophole. And I realize I'll probably get some opposition from people, you know, on that. And I appreciate that I've been fairly strong advocate for our right to the Second Amendment, but I do have some experience sitting across the table with somebody with a 38, not sure whether they wanted to shoot themselves or shoot me before they shot themselves. I'd be concerned about some of these categories.
I appreciate, Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, I do appreciate the point you're making, and I think that that is probably one of probably several areas in this concept, some of which we probably do not even realize yet, that will likely need some thoughtful review and possibly refining. And the reason I bring that up is to hopefully put you at ease a little bit in that we, through state police, intend to continue to work on this compliance with this federal law that requires the states to provide this information to the federal government through the interim to make sure that we're doing it right, that we're providing the correct information, and to make sure that our relief provisions are actually going to work the way we believe they should.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me on this a little bit. And I do appreciate that things like this take a little bit of massaging before you get it correct as such. So I still remain concerned about these issues. I bring these issues up because there are people here who will probably be in the legislature when an issue like this comes back, and I'd like to have that little bit of institutional memory preserved maybe for that. So
yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think we have any more questions for the two of you. So, Mr. Sterrett and
thank you.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder, Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I was somewhat distracted this weekend.
Just congratulations,
by the way.
Into
this. Thank you. I'm only going to bring up one concern. Our concern with regard to the mental retarded definition has been taken care of. And perhaps the issue I'll bring up is going to be has been taken care of, but the Disability Rights Oregon representative brought up at a prior meeting the fact that back in the -4s or 5s, we changed those to say that the agencies did not have to participate in the program until they were fully funded. And my concern, or his concern, and that which I echo, and in a email to Mr. Yandell, he articulated this on the 29th of May, and I didn't see a response on my emails. But that is, if two of those agencies, say DHS and the courts, were to be funded fully and the Psychiatric Review Board was not, and those individuals were prohibited, were reported, and perhaps unjustly, there would be no venue through the Psychiatric Review Board for appeals. And so I have not seen that addressed. I have not heard that it has been addressed, but that, I think, is a major concern that should be addressed somewhere in this bill at some point. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Just a couple of things I want to get on the record that I don't know that I have in a couple of times we've testified here. First, maybe beyond the scope of what you do here, but I have to wonder why, if we have people who are a danger to themselves and others, why they're out there possibly walking into gun stores. If they're that dangerous, I don't understand why they're free, but that's another issue. Representative Gelser brought up what my biggest concern was, and that is the reason I've gotten to know Mr. Yandell and the folks at the State Police ID Unit so well is because for some months we've communicated with them about the many, many times I hear from people who've been denied or delayed firearms purchases because of incorrect criminal records. And those records, at least theoretically, are public. And State Police ID Unit has really done a lot of work to try to fix that. But my concern now is that we've greatly narrowed the mental health record information that the state police can get. If the case that Representative Gelser suggested happens, and I believe it will, just because errors take place in records and errors take place in the records we have now, if a person's denied and they're told it's because of a mental health issue, the bill has an appeal provision for someone who actually does have a mental health issue, but it doesn't have anything in place that I see for a person who's been flagged incorrectly. And I can tell you from the people who I hear from who've been denied or delayed firearms rights unjustly, they are really, really upset and embarrassed and feel very badly that their rights have been taken away, even temporarily, when they've done nothing wrong. And I think if we were to say to them, these same people now, that they not only have to go deal with police and criminal records, but they're going to be called upon to justify themselves to a psychiatric review board, I think that has potential to be a real serious problem and not something I would want to explain to those people. And I should tell you that just today I read a story about a soldier who returned from Fallujah, applied for a gun license in Omaha, Nebraska, was denied because he was being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder, and as so, under federal law, he was a mental defective. And he had to go to an appeal through an appeals process to demonstrate that the fact that he sought treatment did not make him mentally defective. And while we have in this law much more narrowly defined what the feds can get, I'm not sure if we're going to achieve what the bill intends if we're not giving the feds what they want, if we're not giving them sufficient information for them to determine if, in their mind, someone's mentally defective, if they're even going to accept this law. So I would just ask you to consider that if possible, if there is a way to build in a procedure so that a person who's been unjustly denied or delayed based on incorrect mental health records, that there be some way for them to address that without the embarrassment of having to tell people they now need to appeal to any kind of psychiatric review board.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Oh, wait, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, based on your analysis, whether you would, I understand you're pointing out some potentials, but does that allow you to come down in favor of the bill, or neutral, or opposed?
Chair Robles, Representative Reed, this bill is attempting to get us into compliance with the federal law. My organization and many other organizations and one national pro-gun organization oppose the original law based on the fact that it expanded what we believe is an unfair and unjust prior restraint on a firearms purchase. So I would be opposed to complying with the federal law in any event. I know that my vast persuasion don't always necessarily guarantee that that's going to happen. If my hope would be that you would agree that the complying with this federal regulation is not a great idea, in the event that you absolutely determine that it is, and as we've said here before, this was a response to Virginia Tech, but had this law been in place, Virginia Tech would have happened exactly as it did. I would like to see some safeguards so that 6 months from now, I'm not hearing from people who are saying, why was I delayed? Now they say I'm crazy, when now they just say, why am I delayed? They say I have an outstanding warrant out of California, and I've never been to California.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2853, and I will carry over a work session. We'll figure out what we're going to do with that tomorrow. That gives people a little time to read the thing and find out, because it has been going pretty quickly. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 773. And we'll get a short explanation, and Senator Burgess is here.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 773 modifies who can serve as trustee of a legal expenses trust fund. It allows a public official to appoint a trustee or his or her own trustee of the fund. It removes a provision prohibiting a public official from soliciting contributions to the trust fund, declares an emergency. It's effective upon passage. This is an outgrowth of Senate Bill 10 in 2007, and I'll let the speaker speak to it.
Okay. Senator Burdick, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeannie Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, including your very own Representative Nolan. I am here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 773. As your committee staff told you, the Senate Bill 10 of the last legislative session prohibited the use of campaign funds for election law violations and civil penalties. But there is a process in Senate Bill 10 for setting up a legal trust. And in order to have a legal trust, you have to apply to the Ethics Commission, and you have to have a trustee who is not one of your relatives, not one of your employees, basically a separate trustee. And then it says that the trustee must raise the money for the legal trust. And the legal trust, of course, can only be used for specified legal expenses. The trustee has to raise the money, and the trustee has to do all the reporting and all the legal requirements of the trust. But if the trustee messes up, then all the penalties go to the office holder. So you have no control over the trust, and yet you are, as a public official, you are responsible for the consequences if it's not done right. What that means in practice, and I did actually have a legal trust, which is did its job and is now closed down. What that means is that in practice, if you don't hire a lawyer to be your trustee, you're taking an unreasonable risk. The good thing, what Senate Bill 773 tries to do is preserve the good policy objectives of that provision of Senate Bill 10 while getting rid of some of the burdensome and very expensive provisions. So Senate Bill 773 would allow it would still require a separate fund for a legal trust, and those funds would be designated only for that particular legal matter. It would have deadlines under which it, had to finish its work, basically. But it would allow the office holder to serve as their own trustee and to raise their money for the trust. So what this would do is it would put the person who's accountable in charge of doing the work, but it would preserve the good policy objectives of having the trust be transparent, for contributors to know clearly what they are contributing to. In other words, in the old days when they used campaign funds, somebody would contribute to a campaign, and that may be used for campaign or it may be used for legal expenses. So I think it's a very positive policy matter to have contributors know what their contributions are going to be used for. And so this would preserve that good policy aim, but it would get rid of the burdensome and, I think, frankly, unconstitutional requirement that would prohibit an office holder from raising their own funds. That is a form of speech. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. This came through the Senate Rules Committee without any opposition, and the person who actually wrote the provision in Senate Bill 10 was in the room and had no problem with it. So there's been no opposition to this.
Any questions of this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Can I comment?
Yes, please.
Senator, thank you. There were a lot of glitches in Senate Bill 10, and I think you personally found one. And I appreciate that you're willing to step forward and say, we need to clean this up.
Thank you.
So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 773. people okay with moving this bill today? We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 773. So we'll open a work session and...
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 773 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 773 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reese?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. Anybody here want to carry this bill?
Consent.
No.
Calendar?
Oh, pardon?
Consent calendar?
I will carry it.
Okay.
At this point,
Representative Berger will carry this bill.
Okay,
Representative.
I will carry.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on 773 Senate bill. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2010, and this one will be a fairly short one. This is a bill which will not be used for what's in the bill. And I just wanted to let that on the record for people in that public hearing that we will be using this bill for, as we move forward with the constitutional amendments we've already sent over when we start doing things on ballot titles and so on. This is the place where that happens. And I just thought I'd like to keep things open with everybody here about where it's going on. We'll also be looking at other amendments that people may want to put in this bill, but this is the vehicle for that to happen. So. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 2010, just so people know. And so you won't see it for a while, but just wanted you to know that
look
one.
Look out.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll love it.
Let me do Sam Haley?
Yes.
2 minutes?
Yeah, let's do that one. We're going to open a public hearing on SCR 15. Thanks for asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. I appreciate your attendance to this particular measure. It is honoring a gentleman who actually doesn't live in my district, but that I've known since I was a child. He's a lawyer here in town, not a practicing attorney, but a civil servant, really, and was our first legislative counsel, believe it or not. Hmm. On the PUC, had a lot to do with the formation of that whole system. A wonderful human being, one of those folks who got people together to get things done in the very best of ways. And all on later in his life, that was the way he was his entire life. He died about a month ago. We had a nice session in the Senate in his honor. I would like to take this to the floor and honor him further. A great man and one who had a lot to do with how things work down here. So I'd appreciate your support of this resolution.
Any questions of this witness? Okay. There is no one else, so we're going to close our public hearing on SCR 15. We're going to open a work session on SCR 15. I'll entertain a motion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 15 to the floor with a be adopted.
Recommendation.
Recommendation.
Very good. Representative Berger moves SCR 15 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Representative Berger, would you be willing to get
I
it?
Would very much like to.
Very good. We are going to open a very short public hearing on Senate Bill 734 because we had somebody here who has come from a long ways to talk. Is that the person?
Long distance call.
Oh, long distance call. That's right. We had a call worked out. Thank you. So we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 734. And we'll take a little testimony and then we'll carry it over to tomorrow.
Chair, members of the committee. I'm Erica Hagedorn here today on behalf of Pfizer. It's appeared that I've outlasted all my other coalition partners, and we're trying to get Dr. Charles Bentz, who's a tobacco cessation expert from Portland, on the line. But we may or may not be able to do that because he's running a clinic right now. Just really quickly, I think I've had a chance to visit with each of you on this bill. We're working with a broad coalition, March of Dimes, Diabetes, Heart, OMA, to pass this bill that requires health insurance companies to cover tobacco cessation programs that have been approved by the U.S. Public Health Service. The CDC estimates this kind of coverage is just about 10 cents per member per month. It passed out of the Senate 25-4. Regents testified in support also in the Senate, and none of the other health insurance companies have voiced opposition publicly. We've heard that there's a possibility of amendments to this bill, and we'd just like to share with the committee that we hope this bill can move forward unamended. We know that there are other conversations that folks would like to have due to the broad scope of the bill's relating clause, and we hope that this bill related to health insurance. That's right. We hope this bill can move forward unamended and those conversations can occur in other arenas. We feel that this bill is about choice, and if an Oregonian chooses to quit smoking, we hope that they'll have the opportunity through this bill. Thank you.
Not going to work. He's on hold. Do you have a question?
Just a comment. Being the only smoker on the committee... I'm a pretty good vote on this one, I think. So.
Any other discussions? We're on hold, so we'll wait for... we'll kind of go on as we wait to see if we can get this work. We'll take a short recess. While we wait for that person.
I can go out and have a cigarette then.
Recess. Is he here? Oh, he's here. Okay.
We're back.
Which button? We're
waiting on
it. Are you there? Hello. Very good. So we're back in our off of our recess, and thank you for joining us. We're just taking testimony on our Senate Bill 734, which has to do with smoking cessation programs.
Yes, I appreciate that.
And so if you just give for the record your name and then the testimony.
Yes, this is Charles Bentz, B-E-N-T-Z. I'm an internal medicine physician practicing in Portland, Oregon, and I want to state for the record I appreciate you guys letting me call in. I'm in between folks right now, and I just appreciate the ability to testify.
Thank you.
The testimony that I would have, and again, to give, for those of you who may not know, I was the medical director for the Providence Tobacco Cessation and Prevention Program for over a decade, and I work around the country helping health systems and hospitals and clinics set up programs to address tobacco. I'm a health services researcher on the issue of addressing tobacco in healthcare, and I've worked to try to get doctors to do a better job with helping their patients quit. I've set up cessation programs, and I've worked with insurance companies around the country to try to get them to step up and cover tobacco cessation. And I've been doing this for 15 years and working pretty hard at it. And so what I'm saying to you is from work in the trenches as well as the evidence, and the biggest thing I can say about this bill is that it's exactly what's needed. We have been working to try to get health systems and health plans to address tobacco, and right now we're about 20-30% of them who actually are addressing tobacco comprehensively. And the health systems that aren't doing it really do need this mandate. One of the things that we know is that. Giving them the right idea or the right thing to do argument, it gets about a third of the health plans to do the right thing. After that, you can have customers say, hey, listen, we want tobacco, we want a tobacco benefit, and then that will lead another proportion of the health systems and health plans to cover tobacco. But at this point in time, we still have half of the plans in Oregon not covering, tobacco cessation for their patients. And so, this bill is important, and I would strongly encourage all of you that are sitting around to consider passing this without amendment. The one thing that I've heard about is that people are considering, you know, incentives or some type of a thing to get the health system or the health plan or the insurance company incentives. They've had incentives. This saves money in the long term. This is something that actually every dime you spend, it makes money after a period of about 2 or 3 years. You actually save money. The problem is that their event horizon for their return on investment is, you know, is the next quarter. So they just don't see it. And the most important thing that you can do is to pass this bill as it is without amendment. In my own opinion, which is, I think, informed, it doesn't go far enough, but it's a great start. And it's one of the best things, and it's something I've been working towards for 15 years. And I would just open it up to any questions that you may have.
I, for one, appreciate the work you're doing, and I know that this is one of those areas where there are some programs now that work pretty effectively, and if we get the right people together, we can make a difference in people who are smoking.
That's exactly true. I know in the pharmacist-assisted cessation program that I put together, it's got one of the highest success rates in the nation right now with some of the new medicines and the new behavioral techniques. The biggest thing I did was I put together an inpatient cessation program within Providence. Last year, we intervened with over 10,000 hospitalized smokers in the three Portland hospitals. So these are the three hospitals in Portland. So the Providence Hospital, St. Vincent, Portland, and Milwaukee. We put in a program where we identified every single smoker and we had someone go up and intervene with them. That's 10,000 hospitalized smokers last year. And the biggest problem was that most of the smokers didn't have benefits to cover a good cessation program after they left the hospital. And with this bill, every single one of those insured smokers would technically have a program that they could go to. And we actually had a program there. They just didn't have it covered. So this bill would be a dramatic help to Oregonians. And it's something that I just strongly encourage you to look at.
Representative Berger has a question for you.
Thank you, Dr. Benz. What constitutes, in your opinion, a good cessation program? How would we know it if we saw it? And what are the sort of returns on smoking? As an ex-smoker, I can tell you that quitting smoking is not easy, and it takes a lot of tries before you get there. So how do you measure a program such as yours? I mean, what are the benchmarks?
Yes, that's just an outstanding question, that you measure by its success. And you look at, and a good program will do three things. It'll have state-of-the-art behavioral change. So someone who's a trained behaviorist to help people with that, just motivation and learning how to be a non-smoker. There's a true behavioral change. And the second thing is medications. The medications we have now really help. And as an ex-smoker myself, I can tell you that it's tough. And most people go through a number of times before they actually hit a good, you know, before they quit for good. And you need to have just repeated encouragement and medications to help people actually make the quit. And the behavioral changes to help them stay quit. And then the last thing a good program needs to do is they need to show you that they are measuring their outcomes, and they need to have an independent, non-biased way of doing that. And what we do is that we would measure, we'd call people up, and we would ask them if they were quit or not, and if we couldn't find them, we counted them as smokers. It's something they call an intent to treat analysis, and that's something that's so important to do. And there are a number of excellent programs in the state right now that do this. Kaiser offers a great cessation program. Providence offers a great program. We're building stuff within the legacy health system to have a great program. Within a year, we'll have something up and running. We have so many excellent programs that are just there, but what we don't have is we don't have the means for someone to pay for. And that's really the missing link right now.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for allowing me to testify. And again, this is just great, and I'm just hoping the right thing happens. All the best.
Thank you.
We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 734. We're going to carry over the public hearing and the work session to tomorrow. So thank you for that. And I'm going to do one more public hearing, short one, because we have some people from Lane County, and I don't want to make them go back and forth. And that has to do with Senate Bill 560. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 560. And we'll take that testimony, and then we won't have to force them to come back every day.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 560 permits the dissolution of a county service district if it is no longer necessary for the purpose for which it was formed. Senate Bill 560 adds to the current statutory grounds to dissolve a county service district without an election. Currently, ORS 198.940 permits the dissolution of county service districts without election if it is required due to the absence of a public need for the district. An instance of a county service district no longer being necessary for its purpose has occurred in Lane County. In Lane County, a Metro Wastewater Service District was created in 1978 that provided funding for the Metro Wastewater Management Commission that did not have the authority to bond. The Metro Wastewater Service District borrowed money in tax-backed bonds and paid it back in 2002 through a property tax surcharge on residents of the district. In 2002, the Metro Wastewater Service District ceded all of its assets to the Metro Wastewater Management Commission to a prior arrangement, but has continued to exist since that time.
Thank you. And with that, we have our two guests. Alex.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I think the committee administrator actually did a fabulous job explaining the situation that exists in Lane County. There's a similar situation that we've discovered that exists up in Clatsop County. And essentially what these are service districts that are formed for a purpose. That purpose, for whatever reason, goes away, and then they are left to be dissolved. And the only option for a Board of County Commissioners is to hold an election to have them dissolved. So what we have suggested here is a very minor change to statute that would let them be dissolved administratively as long as they have fulfilled their initial purpose. And that initial purpose is actually laid out in a document that's created when they are formed. I don't want to leave the committee with the impression that this is a dissolution, an administrative dissolution that can happen in any way that's capricious. There are a number of steps that do have to be undertaken before you can dissolve a county service district, whether through election or, as we propose, administratively. In other words, they do have to still have a public hearing. They still have to deal with any finances that are left and other sorts of public issues like that. The case that we have in Lane County is we've got a service district that's got about $27,000 left. The estimate for an election for that particular district is about $60,000 for the election.
Ann Hannes with Association of Oregon Counties. Since it's running, we're running late. It's a common sense bill. We support it. Thank you very much.
So we're going. Any questions? Yes, Representative Girard.
Thank you. Can you give me just an example of a special district that's formed for a specific reason, and then that reason goes away?
Chair Roblin, Representative Guard, it's not a special district, so it is called a county service district. But in our case, the county service district was formed to provide the financial vehicle to get the money for the sewering, because what we have in place for sewering is what's called an ORS 190 entity. And at the time, it didn't have the proper authority to borrow the money. So this county service district was formed in order to be sort of the financial instrument, and after all its debt was paid off, it had an agreement when it was formed to give all its assets over to this ORS 190 entity. And so as a result, once it paid off all the debt, it was still there, but it had no usefulness.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is this common?
Well, we know that the Sunset Water District up in Clatsop County is the exact same situation, where it was a water district that put in some pipes in the ground and then actually gave those over to the city of Warrenton, so it had no function left. There may be others. We weren't, when we brought it up with the Association of Oregon Counties, those were the only two that we were aware of.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be opposing this bill. It comes from, the issue at hand is in my district, and it's all centered around annexation. And the annexation, it goes back, the sewer issue was what drove, was a big part of the whole annexation issue. And I have some anti-annexation activists in my district who have looked at this bill and they don't like it. You're looking perplexed, Alex. We talked about this before session. My constituents do not like this bill. They feel that, and it's been so many months since I've actually looked at the bill. I will go back and I will call them. We'll go through the language and everything. But at the time, they did not want to get rid of this because they felt that the existence of this district, this Metropolitan Wastewater Service District, was an impediment to annexations that could happen otherwise to provide those services through the city. And so it's highly wrapped up in the annexation issue. I'll be a no. I will also call them tonight, and we'll go through the language of it. And if we're otherwise persuaded, then I'll change my mind.
Alex, yes.
Representative Roblin and Representative Edwards, we worked on the Senate side extensively with the people that you're talking with through Senator Walker's office.
Oh, did you?
We did.
Okay. Well, then that'll come out in my conversation with them tonight. Then they haven't contacted me on this bill since it's been.
Yeah, and that's. I think that if they had, gave them all the opportunity on the Senate side to express their concerns if they had concerns with the bill. And my understanding is that this has nothing to do with an annexation issue. This bill has nothing to do with annexation, and in fact, would like to point out to the committee, this doesn't force anybody's hand. All this does is give county commissioners an option to administratively dissolve a service district if it has fulfilled its initial purpose. It does not then take the second step where this says that Lane County will do this. It simply provides an option.
And I would say that there are a number of places where the construction of levees was done the same way, and it's small groups of people, and all of a sudden they get them, the levees up, they're doing okay, and they don't have any funding source, nobody does anything, and the liability of being on the board is greater than they want to take on, so all of a sudden they can't get anybody to even serve on these things. And I think there needs to be some ways to clear up some of those things, and then if they're needed, they can always reform, but I think there is an opportunity here to do some things that will help counties manage what those different groups are out and around, so we can talk about that some more, too. So thank you. Any other questions? We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 560. We will carry over the work session to tomorrow, and we'll look at that and let you find out. The only other bills we had, Senate Bill 780, we will carry over to tomorrow. And 3237. We'll carry over to tomorrow. I think that takes care of all of the ones we have here.
Did you say 2853? We're taking
2853 will carry over the work session to tomorrow. Yep. Okay, any other information needs to come before our committee? If not, we're going to close our committee on rules. I thank all of you for being here.
Did you